Community Radio.
It's about real people.
Not sound bites.
Not more talking heads.
Not on this show.
Interchange is a community access media forum fostering unfiltered open dialogue on the people, issues, and events impacting life in South Central Indiana and beyond.
Conversations that challenge the ways we perceive the world around us.
Real people.
Real issues.
This is your forum.
This is Interchange.
Hello, my name is Ashley Beeman. Welcome to Interchange. Tonight's show focuses on two activities currently taking place in Bloomington. In one segment, we take a look at the Groups program, an on-campus summer program at IU that helps young people get a running start into the first year of college. In our first segment, WFHB's news director, January Jones, talks with Ross Martini Eiler about issues of transparency and accessibility in the Monroe County Jail.
This is January Jones for WFHB's Interchange. Today I'm talking with Ross Martini Eiler. Ross, you're a member of the Bloomington Christian Radical Catholic Worker Community, and you've been working to get some public records from the Monroe County Jail. Thanks for joining us today to talk about it. Now, to go right to the questions, you mentioned that you were a volunteer with the jail, and that's kind of put you on a process of getting more information from them and figuring out what kinds of things are available. What organization can you volunteer with the jail through? Is that through the county?
Well, it's a good question. I can no longer volunteer through the jail at all. I was a volunteer at the Monroe County Jail starting in 2008. I was in there with New Leaf, New Life. I've always had a real heart and a concern for issues surrounding incarceration. And then in the spring of last year, 2010, I began asking questions, began getting curious about processes of complaints and other things in the jail. And I had a wide variety of questions that I was initially asking about. Left letters and requests for Bill Wilson, who was the jail commander. And eventually, all of those requests were ignored. And so I filed a formal request for access to public records.
So you had been working in the jail as a volunteer with New Leaf, New Life. And so what were you doing that you had? Were you working directly with inmates? Like, what do people do?
Yeah, what I did is I had taught a class with retired Reverend Hal Taylor here. It was called an intake class was the name of it. It had evolved from then. I think the class emerged before I had arrived as a kind of intake class, but it was called Hal and Ross's class, but it was a support group. So we would gather. We had A block. I was there on Tuesday, so I would go into A block, and there would be from anywhere from 8 to 15 of the guys would come in, and we did a variety of things. We did music therapy. We would kind of do short readings. We did poetry discussions. We did all sorts of things to allow folks to kind of talk about their issues and work towards transformational growth.
Is there a lot of kind of those programs in the Monroe County Jail? So do they have like psychological counseling as well, drug counseling, psychiatrists?
No, and it's difficult because New Leaf, New Life has a variety of classes, I think 4 or 5. They have a caseworker who does work on behalf of some of the inmates. They do bingo. It has been difficult because in one of my future complaints to the public access counselor, I mentioned in one of these things that in perceived retribution from my request for public records that I had been kicked out of the jail. The sheriff approached Wayne Martin, one of the board members of New Leaf, New Life, and asked New Leaf, New Life to take responsibility for kicking me out, which New Leaf, New Life was happy to do. Wayne Martin gave me the explanation that he felt New Leaf, New Life was indebted to have allegiance to the sheriff, and so that anyone who found political disfavor or was attempting to reform the jail had no role in New Leaf, New Life. So it's difficult because the presence of New Leaf, New Life enables the sheriff to claim that the Monroe County Correctional Center is incredibly transparent, right? That it's very easy for people to see what's going on in the jail, and everyone knows what's going on in the jail because there's this organization of volunteers from the community who come in and go kind of all the time. The problem, however, is that group is limited only to those who agree in advance not to see anything. There is there's a kind of a litmus test that only the, I mean, obviously, since I was terminated for kind of asking questions with a reform bent, there is an exclusion of any kind of attempt or possibility for real critical transparency through the presence of New Leaf, New Life.
So that experience, what it did give you was kind of an intimate setting with people in the jail, an opportunity for them to talk about a range of things. Mm-hmm. So in that kind of informal setting, mm-hmm. per se, is that's where you got your curiosity up.
Absolutely. And I loved it. And that has been unquestionably, it's difficult to talk about the New Leaf, New Life stuff because that has been by far the most personally painful. I mean, I was there. I was inside the jail for over, for well over a year and a half almost.
Yeah, you build relationships with people during that time.
And it's I personally just found it an incredibly edifying and really rewarding way. The fact is people who are incarcerated are, many of them arrive at that situation in real unfortunate circumstances, but regardless, are in a difficult spot personally, and there's nothing about being locked in a cage that is inherently reforming or, what's the word, rehabilitative. And so to kind of create a space that people feel cared about and people feel validated and people feel that they have value and worth as a person, and to be able to give that just by caring about them and listening to them and looking at them in the eye, I found that to be tremendously rewarding. And I think since then, I have seen at the Catholic Worker House and other places, I've seen lots of the people who I saw in class kind of around town and have been repeatedly, it's made me feel really edified and good seeing them afterwards to hear that time was meaningful to them as well as being meaningful to me. So it's been very sad for me to no longer have that opportunity to go inside the jail.
Well, during that time, though, you obviously heard some things that concerned you. Mm-hmm. So what was the specific intent, I guess, in your mind once you decided to take it that far and ask for the records and then realize, oops, they don't like me asking for the records? Mm-hmm. Was there some specific safety concern or other issue that you were wondering about?
You know, there was no specific, there was no one thing I heard that made me think, I am going to pursue, I just heard the story, therefore I'm going to kind of act out upon it. It was more of just a general, you know, in general, if anyone goes into the jail enough with a open eyes, you'll become concerned about things.
It's a jail, you know.
It's a jail.
Indeed,
indeed, yes, exactly. So my concern and my interest in these records predated and was not limited to any one specific kind of story that I heard. And indeed, that was kind of the attitude that I went into it. It was not fishing for trouble or not hinting. Indeed, I hope, you know, and I really do hope that when these records are disclosed, that they'll be tremendously boring, that the grievances will be trivial and well-addressed and will show that there is no systematic problems going on in the Monroe County Correctional Center. That is my great hope. That was what I've always kind of been hoped and presumed to find. So, it was just kind of, indeed, I was in poking around about what inmate grievance process was, I discovered that these were public records and that you could request them and get copies of them for 5 cents a page. And I thought, well, that's interesting. I would be very curious to see what kind of what those records look like. Mm-hmm. And that's what led me initially to file the initial request for records.
So, but it wasn't exactly like going to the library and making copies.
Right. No. Yes. The process, of course, is there's. Whether you're going for anything, most people who go there are requesting, I don't even remember, there's a sign in the window. If you're requesting this or this or this, this is how you do it. But you go and you just ask for a request for public records and they hand it to you. You fill it out and you hand it back in, and then they have a set time by which they're legally required to respond. If it's, and so that's what I've done. At every step, you know, it's kind of been interesting. At every step along this way, I thought, well, surely this is it. You know, initially I did the kind of informal request.
So you did
didn't
that
come.
In...
Then I started placing the phone calls. I thought, well, once I start calling, then I filed out the formal request. Well, then, okay, this will get me the information. And then when that was denied, I filed the request of the public access counselor. I thought probably just by filing the complaint, we'll kind of grease the wheels enough to get them to turn the documents over.
And when was the first filing of the request with the public access counselor? When did you do that?
I filed that complaint, I think, on the 12th of August. So mid-August 2010. August 2010. And the ruling came down on September 16th. So on September 16th, the Public Access Counselor ruled. The sheriff did eventually respond to my request to say, no, you may not see these records, and submitted a copy of that to the Public Access Counselor. And the Public Access Counselor ruled in formal opinion, no, that these are public records and the sheriff is legally obligated to disclose them. I went in after that initial ruling on September 16th. I went into the office of the sheriff, and the sheriff turned over several of the records unrelated to inmate grievances that I requested.
What records were those?
They were a copy of the Indiana Department of Corrections does an annual report on each of the county jails. So I asked for the copy of that. I asked for a copy of the Sheriff Department annual report, which is available online. I could have gone elsewhere for that. So I asked for a variety of things. But then the sticking point, of course, was the inmate grievance records. I went in to kind of pick them up, and the sheriff turned over essentially everything but the inmate grievance forms. And I kind of pointed out that there was something missing from the request that had been ruled on the Public Access Counselor. And it was at that point in September of 2010 that the sheriff, and I was speaking with Jim Kennedy in person, said, if you want to see more than this, then you have recourse in the courts. And that was his final statement on the issue. I then, following the advice of the Public Access Counselor, filed a second request for the same documents, the inmate grievance forms, using tremendous specificity in what I was asking for to close any kind of loophole that could be made that I wasn't clear in what my request was. That was that request went unresponded for a few months until after the election, at which point it was forwarded to an attorney on behalf of the sheriff, who sent back again a rejection, saying that despite the ruling of the Public Access Counselor, that I would not be receiving these documents. And as I said, kind of along every step of the way, I thought, well, this will do it. So once the Public Access Counselor ruled in my favor, I thought, oh, good, case closed. This will remedy this swiftly. Upon receiving that, the second denial, even after the Public Access Counselor, I in December went and spoke at a public comment at both the County Council and the County Commissioners meeting. Part of the duties of the Office of the Sheriff is to obey the process of county executives, the county commissioners. So I was hoping that they could throw a little process my way and perhaps try to convince, use whatever influence they had to get the sheriff to come into compliance with the ruling of the Public Access Counselor. And the county commissioners and county legal department have been very courteous and very helpful, and from my perspective, very supportive. But again, the sheriff is an elected official, and there's only so much authority or control that any other official in the county has over him.
So the sheriff thinks that he complied with it, or saying that he is, because mm-hmm. he did provide you with those reports that you asked for, mm-hmm. and then he did give you a log mm-hmm. associated with the prisoner grievance forms.
Right.
Right. So you mm-hmm. have like a log that says the date and who complained, but it doesn't really say what they complained about, mm. how it was resolved or addressed, mm. and it's not the actual form you asked for, which was the prisoner grievance form.
Indeed.
That yep. would have the detail about what really happened and if it was addressed mm. and what the official response was.
Right, exactly. Yes, I was given a copy back in September. I was given a copy of the master grievance response log for the years that I requested. And what I had requested was the actual inmate forms themselves, because one-word descriptions, one-word kind of redactions by a correctional officer don't give the kind of detail or information that's really paints a picture of what's going on. It doesn't really create a sense of transparency. So what I requested was the actual forms themselves. When someone fills out a complaint, what are they complaining about? Mm-hmm. And then how did the sheriff respond? What was the response of the given?
And those records have been deemed by the Public Access Counselor and the county officials then in the form of the commissioners and the county attorney as a record that you should be able to see, that the public should be mm-hmm. able to see.
Yeah, I can't speak on behalf of our county officials, but certainly that was the intent behind the help
from Jeff Cockrell that you got, right?
That was my impression of his intent. Yeah, certainly, absolutely. And that was the specific question of the ruling of the Public Access Counselor was, because again, there was the second, that was the purpose of filing the second request
for
records.
Is it an appropriate record for you to see?
What I'm saying is to clarify, I'm not talking about any the master grievance response log. I'm talking about these specific, the inmate grievance forms themselves and the responses. Are those public records to which the public access counselor, for a second time, confirmed?
So what's been happened since May 15th when you got the response from the sheriff that you weren't going to get any further with your request?
On that same day, May 15th, I then signed a retainer with Ken Falk from the American Civil Liberties Union. He is a lawyer who handles prisoner rights issues. I had been in kind of communication with him talking about my strong belief in the importance of jail transparency, that in order to ensure better prisoner rights and to assure that there are not abuses, both civil rights abuses and human rights abuses in our jails, it is absolutely crucial in our political structure for the public to know what's going on in the jail, to be aware when there are abuses. So I kind of made known to him how I thought this was an important civil rights issue, a civil liberties issue. So I signed a retainer with him to do an to begin investigative work. So he sent a letter on June 15th to the county saying that it has been brought to his attention by me that these records have not been released. And why is that? So that's the place we're at now. It does seem, however, that this is probably headed to the courts.
Now, when you sent that letter went to the sheriff, or did it go to the county commissioners?
Ken Falk sent the letter to Jeff Cockrell, who's the Monroe County attorney. It's my impression, though I'm not entirely sure, that he provides legal representations for kind of all aspects of the county, which would include the office of the sheriff. Mm-hmm. The office of the sheriff before then, before I went to the county commissioners meeting, worked through A. Howard Williams. He's a legal deputy out of South Bend, Indiana, who it seems frequently provides legal representations for county sheriffs in the state of Indiana.
So on your behalf, he's just adding a little more, I guess, pressure to the cooker, saying, hey, why don't you provide these letters for my client? What is the county commissioner's stance on this? Have they taken a role at all in trying to get the records beyond Jeff Cockrell's role as the attorney?
Certainly, yes. I met with them at a staff time meeting. My response from the commissioners was that they were very supportive and encouraging. I kind of met with them mainly to say one of my tremendous hesitations in this process is the fact that knowing that taking a county official to court costs the county money, that taxpayer money, that your and my funds, that these funds which are in an economic crisis so important are being spent to pay for lawyers and to fill up dockets and to fill up a courtroom over an issue that really never should have gotten there in the first place. And I've also wanted to make sure that I've gone about things the right way kind of through this whole process. I want to make sure, I've tried to go at pains through this process of the public access counselor to make sure that I'm not skipping a step or that I'm not overreaching my bounds and that I'm doing things kind of at the appropriate level. So I wanted to make sure that this never went to court unless there was absolutely, it was absolutely at the dead end and there was no other way besides going to court. And you would need to speak with them. My impression of the county commissioners was that they were very supportive. They also agreed that it is very important for all county officials to be in compliance with state law and to be in compliance with the ruling of the public access counselor. They spoke very highly of Ken Falk and the American Civil Liberties Union. They definitely encouraged me to go through whatever process needs that I would need to do so to ensure compliance with state law and the public access counselor. But it kind of said that their hands were tied, that they've exercised all the authority they have or they could over the sheriff.
And that issue, just to kind of crystallize that issue, that the county commissioners don't exercise any authority over the sheriff. Who does? What did you discover about that during this process?
Right. Well, I mean, it's interesting. Indiana legal code says that the sheriff is obligated to exercise the process of the county executives, but I'm not sure what the definition of process is. Obviously, I'm guessing that just means kind of formal legal process. So the sheriff as an elected official has very little direct accountability The accountability of the is the electorate. Presumably, that's the system in place. Is the idea that if the sheriff is being unresponsive to the county needs, or to county needs as expressed in elected representatives of the county, then it's the role of the public to know that that's happening. A, and then B, vote the guy out. But essentially, at least at this point, what the county commissioners kind of said to me was that they were not able to force the sheriff's hand.
So, except by lawsuit. And mm-hmm. Actually, the Monroe County Sheriff and the jail were already under the conditions of a lawsuit by the ACLU. Mm-hmm. They were sued by the American Civil Liberties Union for overcrowding issue, mm-hmm. and they settled that case 2 years ago, mm-hmm. but the conditions of that lawsuit, which were, you know, that you won't overcrowd the jail, you won't put people on the floor, mm-hmm. you'll let people have at least an hour of exercise a week, those mm-hmm. conditions end in October. Mm-hmm. Now, was Ken Falk the attorney mm-hmm. on that case as well?
That's right.
So this is Groundhog Day.
Yeah.
In a way, I mean, so Ken Falk and the ACLU, they're very familiar with Monroe County Jail, obviously, mm-hmm. Already.
That's right. And it is worth noting that he has not agreed at this point to litigate. It's just it's in a earlier
exploratory phase.
He
sent a letter on your behalf, mm-hmm. like requesting that mm-hmm. that you get those records, mm-hmm. and so that could tip the scale conceivably.
And another element in the legal process of this is, so the public access counselor is not binding on any official. However, the teeth that's given is that if one sues over access to public records without going through the public access counselor, then one cannot sue for damages. One can only sue for the compliance with state law. However, if one has sued after already having a formal opinion of the public access counselor in their favor, then one is enabled to include damages into the lawsuit itself.
Your next steps then is you're just waiting for a response from the county legal and or the sheriff's department to the letter sent by the ACLU requesting that your records request be fulfilled.
Indeed, that's the next step. Having signed the retainer with the ACLU, I can no longer directly speak with Jeff Cockrell or with Monroe County Legal. So now I am waiting for whatever response the sheriff and the county give to Ken Falk, and then after that, that presumably will potentially move from an exploratory phase to a litigative phase.
Okay. Well, just to kind of wrap up, any closing thoughts for you? You've been through a long process. You've learned a lot about mm-hmm. Our government, transparency, more about the correctional process in our community, mm-hmm. and you've also got to interact with a lot of different officials, I guess, along the way. So mm-hmm. you have any impressions that this has left you with so far?
Certainly, I think one of the most important things that I have learned is the importance of citizen advocacy. We get in a horrible spot when we think democracy means voting. Democracy in its ideal means individuals take the initiative and assume the authority for self-government and self-rule, and that especially our institutions that have the authority to exercise coercion and exercise violence need to be, we need to care about what's going on, and we need people to ask those questions. At one point, very early on, when I was asking through a proxy, I was requesting information about inmate grievance process. The response that I was given via a proxy from Jail Commander Bill Wilson was, quote, "It's none of his business." And that's profoundly untrue, that it is my business. It's all of our business. It's very important that we all care about, pick something, but that find an area in the county of county power and county politics that we care about, and to take the initiative and take the investment to get involved and to find out what's going on. So I think that's been one of the most kind of important parts, important lessons in this for me.
For Interchange, this is January Jones. I'd like to thank Ross Martini Eiler for taking time to explain his journey through the public records process with the Monroe County Jail today. Ross, thanks for coming in.
Support for WFHB comes from Darn Good Soup on the west side of the Courthouse Square. Darn Good Soup is open 11 a.m. to 7:30 p.m., serving 10 to 12 soups daily, plus salads and baked goods. Vegetarian and vegan options abound. Darn Good Soup, it's fast, it's healthy, it's darn good. Online at darngoodsoup.com. Support for WFHB also comes from Farm Fresh Studios, a professional recording studio located in an 80-year-old former church just outside of Bloomington. Farm Fresh Studios offers music production services to ensembles large and small. More information online at farmfreshstudios.com.
Now, Dr. Janice Wiggins and Andrew Kokey speak with Interchange about a very special activity taking place on the IU campus. It's called the Groups Program.
Good evening. I'm William Morris, and I'm pleased to be with Janice Wiggins and Andrew Kokey to talk about the Groups Program, a long-standing, very successful education program that's taking place on the IU campus right now. Janice, Andrew, hello.
Hi there.
Hello.
You know, I've been doing a little bit of research on the Groups Program, and according to your website, it says that the Groups Program has been active or working since 1968, and that makes the program, let me see if I'm doing my math, 43 years old. That's incredible.
Great. That's what's so exciting about this. We're one of the oldest when you turn of Indiana University. I'm looking at programs to help underrepresented students, and this is what this is about. It started out in 1968, as you indicated, and the reason it began, it was because Indiana University lacked at that time many minority students on campus in terms of students of color, whether it be African American or Latinos. And it was doing also, if you look at what was going on nationally, you know, during the 60s, during the riots, the death of Martin Luther King, Senator Kennedy. And all of these things were going on. And then when you look at this campus, which lack any large percentage of African Americans or Latinos, this was a time when the resistance and settings began over nationally because of this. And it was President Starr at that time, then several faculty members who wrote a proposal and wanted to find ways in which they can bring more African American and Latino students to this campus. And it was at that time Professor Gray and several others had written the proposal, and what they did was what they called the Gary Project, and they went up north and brought East Chicago, and they went into Indianapolis, but they selected students they thought who were first generation but underrepresented students to the campus, and that was 43. And that's when we started with Group 43 students. In 1969, they began expanding this program. And it's when they had hired in Roselle Boyd, who was assistant director of the student division, and then they brought in over 200 students. And it's just like in 1969, 200 plus students. Now we're here in 2011, and we still are serving these underrepresented first generation students.
When you say first generation, Janice, what do you mean first generation?
We consider students who are first generation when neither parent have graduated from a four-year institution. Now, some of the parents have gone to a two-year institution, but we say 4 years. And so these students, it just provide, when you say the summer program, it just get them an opportunity to get acclimated to the campus. But more importantly, Many have little or no idea of what college life is about. They tend, you know, so this is their first time, and the parents, it's so gratifying when you see the parents here, because we do offer a day where the parents can come also, so they can be introduced to the campus, introduced to our coordinators of learning, introduced to all the resources that we will have available for the students, their sons and daughters. And when they see this opportunity, they are so gratified that Indiana University is providing this opportunity for their sons and daughters. Because I can't believe how many other institutions provide the resources, and we're talking about financial resources, during the summer so that these students can learn and be successful and feel that they can compete with other students, not only around the United States, but internationally, to compete with other students and graduate from Indiana University. And that's our role. Our role of the program is to give them the support, whether it's all type of academic support, whether it's tutoring, advising, learning communities, whatever it takes, personal counseling, and to help the students begin. But the summer is the key. And students remember the summer when they think of their group year. They say, I'm group 69, I'm group 70, I'm group. They always remember that summer experience because it's their first introduction to college.
How many students are in the program this summer?
240.
And what is it about the summer experience that makes it so unique and so memorable?
Oh, gosh. A lot of it is the first time meeting other students from around the state. And we're talking about not just the urban, but we're talking about rural. This is the first time they have met international students. This is the first time many students, particularly Caucasian, who have from the rural area, they have had little or no interaction with students of color. So it's a beginning, building relationships with other students. It's a beginning of them learning other cultures. So when the university talk about diversity, I think this is the most diverse program that Indiana University has. We're not talking about just ethnicity, race. What we're talking about, whether it's students' performance, SAT scores, what have you, it's the whole realm of things. Economically, because most of our students are low income and first generation. So you have a large combination of differences. And that's what makes it so, I think, exciting for the students. It's learning about differences. And we have such a committed staff. Over 85 or 90 people are working in the summer to make this program successful. I wish I could say the Janice Williams is making it all successful, but it's not. It's the staff. I have 15 known staff, but I go to the English department. They are, we call them stakeholders. The English department. We look at our graduate students who teaches the course. We have about 50 plus of them teaching.
Like Andrew.
Like Andrew, exactly. And I was just mentioning to Andrew and to our coordinators, these graduate students are truly committed. And it's so wonderful to see that they are buying in and taking ownership of this program. And the students build such a great relationship with them. And it's just not the summer. We're talking about during the academic year. Because they have built this relationship, they will meet these students and evolve. We have a program where they take students for lunch. They really want to foster that which would say faculty and student relationship, and they do just that. People who have been in the program, like Kathy Smith for close to 20 years, who's in English, who coordinates our English program. Linda McKinley, who's been in it for over 27 years, who coordinated our math program. And, you know, Chip Frederick. Chip is a new kid on the block. He only been there about 13 years. But he, you know, coordinates our, what is it, reading and reasoning class, critical reading and reasoning. And he's been doing a fantastic job. So you have these individuals. Then you have our writing tutorial. And most of all, you have Cedric Harris, who is a residential life coordinator. He's the one who is living with these students 24/7 a day. He and his staff, and many of his staff are former group students, and these are the RAs, and they are involved, believe me, with the students, creating activities for them. So the students, with these activities, and learning about other culture, and they build this what did you say? This type of relationship with other students.
A synergism.
So that when they, and when they come back in the fall, they already, they know the campus, they already have their friends, they have a set of faculty people they can already relate, and they have our staff. You see, so now they are ready. And to be ready, and they know they have people they can always come to. And that's what they do with advisors.
You know, it's so interesting to listen to you because I hear what I'm thinking is that we're creating not just successful people, but we're creating, your program is creating role models.
Absolutely.
And role models, a new college graduates, so their families in the future will have college graduates, people that can help their grandchildren.
Their families.
That's right, exactly.
And what's so interesting you say that. It's because every year we have students come in, their brother, their sister, their cousin, their aunt, their uncle have come through this program. So when you look at the state and you talk about the economic structure, we are taking people who are low income, first generation, and making them productive citizens of the state. This is what we're doing. And so if you look at, and I think that's what IU is so good about, they feel a commitment to really support this program. And that's the reason why it's been done over 40-something years. You look at other institutions that have support service, because we were formerly of the what we call TRIO program. And this is, when they call it TRIO, this is the United States in 1974 created this program for underrepresented students. We were called the Group Student Support Services. Well, last year we didn't receive our funding from the federal government, but the campus is supporting this program all the way through, and they have always supported. And there's a reasoning why they are still supporting this program, because they see the value in bringing students of color to the campus, students from urban areas, students from rural areas, to give them the opportunity. They see the value in this opportunity. And so when you have administrators who are committed, then you have a staff that is committed and dedicated in working with these students. And then you have this summer program, whether it's resident life, English, whatever, you have stakeholders all through. It's not just this program. Quite frankly, it's the university. You can look at academic units. We can look at other student support units. They have all bought in, and they support this program. So this is why, well, needless to say, I think it's great.
You know, when I'm listening to you, I'm thinking of the 230 students who are presently in the program, and I'm thinking for each 230 students, there may be 23,000 other students who could really benefit from this kind of program. What would it take for Indiana University to get 800 students, for example?
Oh, my God. Let's put it this way.
Because we know that in southern Indiana, in Indianapolis, in Indiana, there's a need. And there are other
right.
children, who other young people who could benefit from this kind of program. Even if they only went to, even if they didn't have a plan to go to IU, if their plan was just to go to Ivy Tech, or not just Ivy Tech, but any other school. What stops us from thinking even bigger than 230 kids?
Well, economic one, but I must say this. There are 13 other programs very similar to groups program at Indiana University Bloomington. IUPUI has one, Indiana State, so you can name Purdue. So they have similar programs. But it still goes back to your question. We still have so many that we could serve, even with these 13 programs, but we can't. And it takes a lot of resources to really bring in that many. My staff many times, Lou Murray, for well, oh, I wish we could serve more students and bring them in. But to do an effective job, the number of staff and people who work with us, it's no way that we can serve. We have served up to about 350 at one time. And it's a difference when you look at that, because now this year with 240, my goodness, we feel like we can breathe a little, we can give more attention and what have you. But clearly, we could serve more. But it's now we have to look at what this economic times for the university and, you know, for other programs, we are looking at that. So we are hoping and we're blessed, quite frankly, that we are able to serve those 230 students right now.
And, you know, some simple math, if we have 43 years in the program at roughly 200 young people a year, we're talking about 8,000 young people who
have over 10,000
young people.
Yes. Students
who have become role models.
And we are we always excited about our alums. We 6 years ago, we established a groups program, Alumni Association, work with IU Alumni Association. So we are affiliate. And I kept thinking, I said, we need to be bringing these alums together. You know, and our first big anniversary, which was the 30th, and my gosh, I couldn't believe the number of alums who returned and were talking about, you know, everyone had a story. It was so good listening. But if you listen to the alums, the first thing they talk about, what impact the groups program made in their lives. Every last one of them. I wish alum was here, because they can articulate so much better than I, because they can tell what it really was like to come to this institution. And whether we like it or not, there's always some discrimination or racism, whatever. But that's not what they talk about. They talk about the impact of this program.
To their
success.
And they
would not have made it. And now their sons and daughters, they wish they can come to the program, but now they're not first generation. And they think, I really want my sons and daughter to come through to have the experience that I had. But alum can articulate so much better, you know, the impact of this program. And so when you hear them speak about, I never would have made it through college if it were not for the groups program. And that is really heartening to hear that. And parents to write me and say thank you. And when they hear leaving their students, they cry. But they are crying because they are so thankful that this institution is doing something so well to help their sons and daughters for the opportunity.
And I can only imagine their tears on graduation day.
Oh, yes.
You know, during our first 15 minutes in the conversation, you have given tremendous props to the teachers, the staff, and we have one of them here with us, Andrew Kokey.
Yeah.
We've launched off on some great thoughts here, and I want to get your observation. Tell us your role in the program right now.
Well, I'm one of the assistant instructors. I teach one of the 18 sections of critical reading and reasoning. I have a class of 14 very bright students who are enthusiastic and very capable.
Now, you teach a class called critical reading. I think you had mentioned to me that there's. Can you give our listeners an idea of the class construct? Like, what would a student be taking in the summertime? What would they be taking during
sure.
the program?
Of course, reading is probably the skill that students need to master the most to do the best in their 4 years at Indiana University. And what we're trying to actually teach during this summer is how best to interrogate an author, how to analyze what is being claimed, how to analyze the kind of support that an author might use for those claims, and you know how to assess how much they agree or disagree with particular claims. So the class is structured around a book by a sociologist named George Ritzer. The book is called McDonaldization. It's an argument about kind of modern society and rationalization. So it's not over their heads by any stretch, but it does introduce a lot of new concepts and new theories, and all of these, you know, require some intellectual wrestling. And so those are the skills that we are equipping them with. And it's a 6 weeks long course. At the same time, they will be taking an English course as well as a math course, which, you know, anytime you're taking a summer course, it's already a difficult task. But these students take three summer courses simultaneously. They're pretty much in class from 9 a.m. till about 3 p.m., which is really admirable. And we have a lot of different pedagogical tricks that we do to keep the students enthused and attentive and to get them critically reading.
What has your involvement meant for you in the program? I can imagine what it's meant for them learning all the things that you have to impart, but what's it meant for you?
Well, first off, the students themselves are very enthusiastic, and they're also, they're very disciplined, and they work really hard. It's like the perfect audience. If you were to get to choose the kind of students that you would teach to, you would pick students who work hard, who are ambitious, who listen closely, and take their work seriously. So it's a great bunch of students, first off. And that gives its own energy, right? And so I'm kind of taking some of my energy and I'm getting it back from, you know, those students. But additionally, I work with 18 other instructors. And we also have Chip Frederick, who Janice has mentioned, and also Molly Burke. So there's a team of 20 people who are in charge of the critical reading and reasoning class. And what I really like about that is that I don't have to necessarily invent the wheel every single day. Instead, I have this whole team of like-minded instructors who are just as enthusiastic as I am, who are smart, capable teachers with lots of teaching experience. And so, like today, for example, I used a lesson that a peer of mine by the name of Carter Neal had proposed just last week. I thought it was a great idea, tweaked it for my class so that it would fit kind of our classroom, adjusted it so for where we are in the book, which might be different from where his class is at this moment. But then I basically employed some of the key thoughts that he had and developed that into a classroom. And it went really, really well. It was a good class today. And what's really great about that is that I'm not going back to the basics every single time. I can borrow some of the energy and thought of my own peers. which is really, really helpful.
How long have you been in the program?
This is my second year teaching.
And I think you told me something about the program seeks to maintain a certain newness. So I think is there a limit on how many years you can teach?
Yeah, that's right. I'm allowed to teach 3 years, and I might teach next summer, but if I get that dissertation done, this will be my last. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's been a blast, and each time I've learned more about, you know, how to be a better teacher, both from, you know, my own successes and mistakes, but also from those of my peers, and we share this. Every single week we have, you know, these training meetings where we talk about successes and failures.
So you taught last summer.
That's right.
Did you see students around, and you're a graduate student, did you see students around the campus during the last school year?
Absolutely. I've met several of my group students from last year. Some of them have asked me for letters of recommendation to get into one program or another, like sociology, for example, or other programs. I've also just, you know, seen them on the sidewalk and asked them how their first year was, how was their group's experience. Sometimes they ask, since I'm in the history program, sometimes they'll ask me about history professors that they're thinking of, you know, taking a class, and we'll just talk about, you know, what might be expected of them and what kind of things might happen in a history course. So, yeah, I've seen them a number of times, actually.
So the job never stops.
Well, it's a great job, so I'm glad it doesn't.
Janice, one of the things that you mentioned is that there are a lot of children in the it's not children. There are a lot of young adults in the program who not only come from African American or Hispanic backgrounds, but they come from international backgrounds of all sorts.
Yes, that is true. I guess the explosion of immigrants, and particularly from Afghanistan. We have had several students from Afghanistan. And it's very interesting that you asked that. I had a student, part of the group's program have what we call a partnership agreement, okay? And students are coming from different cultures, and they want to maintain their culture. And they are afraid, the parents are afraid that they would lose their culture if they are interacting with so many other people that are not part of their culture. And so interesting enough, I just quickly go through this. The mother did not want her daughter to stay in the dormitory. But I kept saying to her, this is a wonderful opportunity for these students to learn about differences. This is part of what we are. And if you would give your daughter the opportunity to be a part, even though, you know, this is the mother, but the daughter was really ecstatic about being a part of this program. It ended up, yes, they finally agree to let their daughter come through. And now she's into everything. If you could see her, it is so different. We've had students from Africa. Our students travel abroad. It's just amazing to have this type of influx coming into the university. So we help it. We do that. And I'm just really proud to be a part of this program. I really am.
And go ahead, please.
Finish. I know my graduate student want to ask and said, what is it about it that you like? About this program, you have an opportunity to always tell them to make an impact on young people's lives. What better job is that? So that's what I feel about the program.
Well, our listeners can't see our faces now, but I'm smiling from ear to ear just at the enthusiasm and energy that you bring to this. You're listening to Interchange, and I've had the great pleasure of talking with Janice Wiggins and Andrew Koki about the Groups program. A 43-year-old education program at Indiana University, highly successful, that helps underrepresented and first-generation students to a path of success at the school. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Now,
Now, at the last minute, William Morris takes a look at the NFL and the wealth gap in the United States.
I have to tell you, I have loved football all my life, and I played it at a fairly high level in high school and college. But I have to admit that when I read headlines about the economy, talk about folks losing wages, rising costs, lack of insurance and retirement security, I shake my head in disgust watching Obama and Boehner argue Reaganomics versus grassroots. I wonder who even cares about the recent strike in the NFL. On TV, they'll refer to it as the 132-day strike, and I'm not even sure how many people think it's important. At the same time as this NFL strike comes to an end, I recently read some information about a research conducted by the Pew Research Center, where the wealth gap in the United States has grown into a wealth chasm. According to the study, median income among Hispanic families has fallen 66% in the last 5 years. At the same time, median income for African American families has fallen 53%. And it's easy to dig deeper into these statistics for all they might mean. But when I put the dire situation in those statistics up against this so-called NFL strike, I have to wonder, is there a disconnect that I'm missing someplace? A friend of mine recently commented that in the 19th century, Marx would have said that religion was the opiate of the masses. But now he says he doesn't think it's religion, it's professional sports. This is William Morris for The Last Minute.
Thank you for listening to Interchange. Your thoughts and ideas are welcome. Contact us at interchange@wfhb.org. That's interchange@wfhb.org. Thanks to our assistant producer, Shang Young, for engineering tonight's program. Interchange is produced by William Morris. The executive producer is January Jones. Original theme music is by Jamil Effiam. Additional music by Black Star and the Crusaders. I'm Ashley Beeman. Tune in next week at this time for Interchange. Right now, stay tuned for Stardust with Tillman here on your community radio station, WFHB.
Real people.
Real issues.
This is your forum.
This is Interchange.
Written and produced entirely by volunteers working in the studios of Community Radio WFHB in Bloomington, Indiana.
Interchange fosters unfiltered open dialogue on the people, issues, and events impacting life in South Central Indiana and beyond.
Comments, suggestions, and program ideas may be sent directly to the Interchange staff.
The email address is news@wfhb.org.
That address once again is news@wfhb.org.